For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I recently started going through the Book of Serenity koan collection in some of my talks, and I'm going to continue today with case two of the Book of Serenity. The Book of Serenity is the koan collection that's used most in Soto Zen, the branch of Zen we do here, which comes from Dogen in the 1200s, who brought it from China to Japan. And just to say, there's a lot of misunderstanding of what koans are. They are not illogical riddles to solve. They certainly do not follow discursive Western style logic, but they express the logic of awakening. So these are teaching stories that have been studied for 1,000 years or more because they have something to do with our own practice. And the point of studying them, there are some branches of Zen where there's a curriculum where you study one until you present some acceptable response to it and then go on to the next ones. In the Dogen tradition and in the Soto school, we don't study them that way. Dogen spoke about all of these koans extensively and was a master of them, but the point is just to use these as teaching stories to help us see aspects of our own practice. Case two, in Thomas Cleary's translation, he calls Bodhidharma's emptiness. So this is the story of Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu, which is case one in the other one of the other main koan collections, the Blue Cliff Record. The Book of Serenity is very much modeled after that. There's cases and verses, and in the case of the Book of Serenity, they were selected in the verse commentary written by Tiantong Hongzhe, whose practice writings I translated in Cultivating the Empty Field, which we've studied. And then later on, another Saodong or Soto teacher wrote introductions and commentaries to the case and the verse. So that's by way of introduction. This story about Bodhidharma, in some ways we could say this is the first or the primary Zen story. So this is kind of the beginning of Zen. Bodhidharma was this Indian master who came to China and the 500s, I think it's, and he's, there are many, many stories and legends about him such that Western Buddhist historical scholars used to say that he didn't really exist. He was just a kind of made-up figure because some of the stories are so outlandish. Maybe I'll mention some of them, but actually we know now that through further research that he did exist, and probably even, or it's possible even, it's highly likely even, that the story about Bodhidharma's meeting with Emperor Wu is based on something historical. So Emperor Wu, so I'll read the case in the Book of Serenity first. Emperor Wu of Liang, a kingdom in southern China, asked the great teacher Bodhidharma, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" Bodhidharma said, "Empty, there's no holy." The emperor was taken aback and said, "Who are you facing me?" Bodhidharma said, "Don't know." The emperor didn't understand. Bodhidharma subsequently crossed the Yangtze River, went north in China, came to Shaolin Monastery, and faced a wall for 9 years. So in some ways, this is the first story of Chan, or Zen. Chan's the Chinese way of pronouncing Zen. Japanese say Zen. There are other stories that I could claim as the first story, but in some ways this is really the primary story of Zen. And Bodhidharma is on our altar to the, on this side, to the left, standing, a standing figure. When I went to China in 2007, the first year I was living in Chicago, I did a tour with Andy Ferguson, who has spent a lot of time in Chinese Zen sites, and we went to Shaolin. There's a mountain there and a cave up at the top, which is where Bodhidharma sat for 9 years, facing the wall. Later on, we went to another temple where he actually was the teacher a little later on, Kongshang, Empty Form Temple. And at that place, one of my students from California presented this to us as a cedar statue of Bodhidharma standing, so you can look at that later. Bodhidharma is often depicted as very fierce, with a big frown, sometimes with big eyes, because it's said that during those 9 years of sitting facing the wall, to stay awake, he cut off his eyelids and threw them on the ground, and out of the eyelids grew tea, which is began the tea culture in Zen, and which led to tea ceremony or chado in Japan. Anyway, there are lots of these stories about Bodhidharma, and sometimes he's depicted with very big eyes. But he sat facing a wall in this cave at the top of Shaolin Monastery for 9 years before he went out and actually taught or said anything to anybody else. But at first he went to southern China, and he met with the Emperor Wu, and before the earlier part of this exchange is Emperor Wu, who had built many monasteries and arranged for the ordination of many monks and nuns and translations of many sutras. These sutras claim that doing such things produces great merit. So Emperor Wu, who was a Buddhist patron, and here was this master coming from India, the homeland of Buddhism, asked Bodhidharma, "What merit have I gained from all of those good works I've done?" And Bodhidharma just said, "No merit." So that's the beginning of this dialogue before the case that's actually selected in the Book of Serenity. Then Emperor Wu asked, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" So Emperor Wu was a very sincere student of Buddhism. He wanted to know, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" And Bodhidharma just said, "Empty, nothing holy." So, you know, we practice with these robes and all the forms of walking around and bowing and offering incense. But it's not something special or holy. This is just our expression of expressing Buddha in our own body, mind, and expressing our gratitude to the ancient Buddhas, the tradition of Buddhas and ancestors like Bodhidharma. So the emperor was taken aback when Bodhidharma said, "Empty, nothing holy." And he said, "Well, who are you facing me?" And Bodhidharma said, "Don't know." And so this is a warning to any of you who think you know who you are, that who we are is deeper and wider than our personal histories, and it includes, of course, all of our personal karma of grasping and anger and confusion. But who are you? Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." The emperor was confused. He didn't understand. And then Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River to the north, came to Shaolin, and faced a wall for 9 years. That's the version in the Book of Serenity, which we're focusing on. But this is also the first case, the very first case, in the Blue Cliff Record. And often it's used in the Shuso ceremony, the ceremony for the head monk, when they're questioned, they use this version from the Blue Cliff Record. Recently, Aishin, our recent Shuso, used a story about Vimalakirti, the great enlightened layman of Buddha's time, and Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. But let me read you the part of the Blue Cliff Record that's a little different. So it has the exchange the same as in the Book of Serenity between Emperor Wu and Bodhidharma. And then it said, after this, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei. So it doesn't mention, as the Book of Serenity does, that he came to Shaolin and faced a wall for 9 years. And then there's a whole other section of the Blue Cliff Record story. Later, the emperor brought this up to Master Zhe, who was his Buddhist teacher, who taught the Buddhist sutras and texts, and asked him about it. And Master Zhe said, does your majesty know who this person was? And the emperor said, I don't know. So that's a contrasting I don't know. Master Zhe said, he is the Mahasattva, the great being of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, transmitting the Buddha mind seal. When he heard this, the emperor felt regretful, so he wanted to send an emissary to go invite Bodhidharma to return. Master Zhe said to him, your majesty, don't say that you will send someone to fetch him back. Even if everyone in the whole country were to go and go after him, he still would not return. So that's the version in the Blue Cliff Record. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Bodhidharma back together again in southern China. There's a little different emphasis in these two versions. One of the contexts of the Blue Cliff Record is to state strongly that Bodhidharma was an exemplar, an incarnation even, of the Bodhisattva of compassion, who we also have images of in our Zendo back there and over here. It's hard to see unless you look closely, but the Bodhisattva of compassion who listens to the suffering of the world. And to say that Bodhidharma was the Bodhisattva of compassion after he abandoned Emperor Wu, from one point of view, is part of the koan in the Blue Cliff Record. So each of these teaching stories have many aspects often, and this one does too. But the version in the Book of Serenity that we're focusing on doesn't talk about Emperor Wu after Bodhidharma left. It just says Bodhidharma came to Shaolin, to this monastery, and faced a wall for 9 years. And the commentary after by Wansong, a great later 13th century Chinese Shaodong or Shaodong master, emphasizes, well, why did Bodhidharma do this? How does the teaching get transmitted? What's the point of just facing a wall for 9 years? How does this... So, in some ways we could think of Bodhidharma like Suzuki Roshi, my teacher's teacher, who brought Zen to California in the 60s. Bodhidharma was going from India to China. Very different cultures, very different countries. China already had Buddhist teaching, and they had many Buddhist scholars and Buddhist monks who had studied the Dharma, the teaching of Buddha. But what Bodhidharma was bringing was this actual practice of Zazen that we've just been doing, sitting, facing the wall, as Bodhidharma did, being present and upright, and allowing, I would say, and Dogen would say, allowing Buddha to be present on your seat in this body-mind. That's not something that Bodhidharma explained, but what he did, he left Emperor Wu, and he went and faced a wall for 9 years. Suzuki Roshi came to San Francisco and worked in the Japanese community there as a priest of Soto Zen, which was a second most popular form of Buddhism in Japan. So he was initially a priest for the Japanese-American community who knew something about Buddhism and had known about Zazen, although he stressed Zazen more than all of the ceremonies and chanting that was part of big part of Japanese Soto Zen. But then, being the 60s, there were all these people who showed up who had heard about Zen, and this was the 60s, and there were all these hippies in San Francisco. And Paul Disco, who was here recently and spoke several times, was one of them who showed up at Tassajara on his motorcycle. And he talked about Suzuki Roshi. It's now on our website. You can listen to what he says. But it was a different situation. But in some ways, it's, you know, actually a bigger transition between cultures from Japan to America. Anyway, India to China was also a large transition. But all of the 60s hippie-type people who came to sit with Suzuki Roshi did not have a background in Buddhist teaching like the Emperor Wu did. They had a lot of ideas about, we might say New Age, or about spirituality, or trying to get free of Western spirituality. But it's interesting to think of this as a transition, like the transition we're doing by bringing this practice to Chicago. Anyway, he faced the wall for 9 years. I'll read next and I might come back to talk about it some, but the verse that Hongzhe wrote commenting on this. Empty, nothing holy. The approach is far off. Succeeding, he swings the axe without injuring the nose. Failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. Still and silent, coolly, he sat at Shaolin. In silence, he completely brought up the true imperative. The clear moon of autumn turns its frosty disk. The Milky Way thin, the dipper hangs down, its handle in the night. In succession, the robe and bowl have been imparted to descendants. From this, humans and divinities have made medicine and disease. So at the end, he's referring to the transmission of the robe and bowl and the continuing of this tradition, which Bodhidharma, considered the founder of Chan or Zen in China, started, according to this story. And still we do Dharma transmission and passing along robe and bowl. And so the question is, how does this practice and teaching continue? And it's always the question here in Chicago, in our time, a very different time from what Bodhidharma faced. Hongzhe calls the true imperative, and silence, it completely brought up the true imperative. And then Hongzhe is very poetic, the clear moon of autumn turns its frosty disk. How does that continue? How is it that we here are able to practice this practice that Bodhidharma did, facing a wall for 9 years? So the Blue Cliff Record version sort of emphasizes again, you know, him turning away from Emperor Wu. The commentary in the Book of Serenity refers to Prajnatara, who was Bodhidharma's teacher in southern India. Prajnatara once instructed Bodhidharma, the great teacher, 67 years after my death, Prajnatara said, you will go to China to present the medicine of the great teaching. So Buddhism is often talked about as medicine, as healing from the difficulties we face because of the suffering we create with our own greed, hate, and delusion, because of the suffering created by our society, whatever society exists at the time in some ways. So Prajnatara said, present the medicine of the great teaching, showing it directly to those of excellent faculties. So part of Zen that seems mysterious or puzzling or illogical or whatever is to get through our usual ways of thinking. Not that our usual ways of thinking can't be helpful at times, but there's something deeper. So when we sit Zazen, we have the chance of connecting, communing with the calm uprightness of the Buddhas, of settling some, of seeing our own patterns of grasping and anger and so forth, but also communing with something much deeper, the true imperative, as Hongzhi says. It's not that it's something holy, because again, Bodhidharma said empty, there's no holy. So it's not about finding some great sacred understanding or seeing some great exalted vision of, you know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, flashing lights and so forth, or, you know, experiencing something like that. Those kind of experiences happen, but they're not the point. So, going back to Prajnatara, talking to Bodhidharma back in India, he said, present the medicine of the great teaching, showing it directly to those of excellent faculties, but be careful not to go too fast and wither under the sun. So Zen particularly, maybe Buddhism generally, is not about going out and preaching on street corners and so forth. We have this humble little storefront temple that people can come to, but don't go too fast. You'll wither under the sun, Prajnatara said. When you get there, don't stay in the south. There they only like fabricated merit and don't see the inner reality of Buddhahood. So, you know, it's funny in many cultures, Southerners get put down, you know. It happens here too. And Prajnatara, you know, we don't know that Prajnatara said this historically, but this is later Wansong saying what I'm sure he got it from some earlier tradition, what Bodhidharma was told by his teacher. Said, don't stay in the south. There they only like fabricated merit. And, you know, in Emperor Wu's defense, a lot of the sutras do talk about creating merit by the sutras or scriptures say, if you read this text, if you do meditation, if you chant and so forth, you will get lots of merit. And, you know, that's part of the culture of Buddhism in Asia. And, you know, we can think of merit as positive spiritual energy rather than some merit badge. But anyway... But Prajnatara said, they don't see the inner reality of Buddhahood, so even if you go there, you shouldn't stay too long. So Bodhidharma didn't. He had this exchange with Emperor Wu, and then he split. As it says, after all, it turned out that he did travel to Liang in the south, and then he crossed over into Wei in the north, and remained unmoving for 9 years. So, this is controversial. Did he just sit for 9 years? There are little statues of Bodhidharma or Daruma in Japan that where there's no legs, like his legs fell off from sitting for 9 years, and you knock it over and it bounces back upright. Because the point is this uprightness. So again, you know, because of all these funny sort of superhuman stories about Bodhidharma. Historical scholars thought he didn't really exist, but we know he did now. Wansong goes on, though, in his commentary, in recent times, when Suzhou's robe and teaching were bequested to Renshan, Renshan said, and Suzhou is Wansong's own teacher, so Renshan must have been one of his Dharma brothers. And Wansong is very interesting, and at some point, as we're talking about the Book of Serenity, I'll get into that, maybe even today. But anyway, when Suzhou wanted to bestow his robe and bowl and the teaching, his robe and the Dharma and the succession onto Renshan, Renshan said, I am not such a person. he wouldn't accept it. This is being careful, like Bodhidharma. Sujau said, not being such a person, you do not afflict him. So to think, if he had thought he was such a person, oh yeah, I can take care of that. Yeah, give me the robe, you know, let me spread the Dharma. That would have afflicted him, referring to Bodhidharma. So again, this caution at the beginning of the Zen tradition. This guy sat facing a wall for 9 years. Then Wansong says about his Dharma brother Renshan, because of his deep sense of gratitude for the milk of the true teaching, Renshan raised his downcast eyes and accepted. Suja went on to say, now you are thus, now you are such. Most important, don't appear in the world too readily. If you rush ahead and burst out flippantly, you'll surely get stuck en route. So this is a caution to all so-called Buddhist teachers. And, you know, maybe it was a mistake for me to come to Chicago. I still don't know. 11.5 years later. I don't think so. I think there's lots of really fine practitioners here. And I'm glad of that and that support. But I had been sitting Zazen every day for 25 years before I was given Dharma transmission by my teacher, Reb Anderson. So maybe I didn't do anything too quickly. I don't know. There's a verse then that Wansong quotes, willing to endure the autumn frost so the deep savor of the teaching will last. Even though caught alive, after all, he is not lavishly praised. And actually, Bodhidharma is often, you know, that one of the main koans, one of the main questions in all the koan literature is, why did the first ancestor come from the West? What's the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from China to India? I mean, India to China. And a lot of the koans give interesting answers, like Jiaozhou said, oh, the tree over there in the garden. Anyway, some of the answers are rather vulgar, and sometimes Bodhidharma is described as a pest who brought all this trouble to us by some of the Zen masters, and maybe so. Anyway. Wansong goes on, reading some of his commentary, I say, leaving aside the highest meaning for the moment, what do you want with the holy truths? Tiantong said, just end profane feelings. There's no special holy understanding. So, you know, people come to Zen and other Buddhist practices wanting to know the truth, you know, the ultimate truth. Dharma, the teachings, means also the truth. But if you think there's some ultimate truth, you're missing the point. The Surangama Sutra says, Wansong quotes, if you create an understanding of holiness, you will succumb to all errors. So Bodhidharma just said, empty, nothing holy. This practice is not about reaching some final understanding, some ultimate understanding. It's not that we can't have good understandings of the Dharma, but that's not the point. How is this expressed? How did Bodhidharma express it? How did his successors express it? And there's not one right way to do that, so we don't have to all go find a cave and sit facing the wall for 9 years. But there's some caution here. As Wan Song's comment continues, the ancients sometimes came forth, sometimes stayed put, sometimes were silent, sometimes spoke. All were doing Buddha work, the work of awakening. So there's not one right way to do this. There was one teacher in China who, whenever a student came to see him, he would turn around and face the wall and ignore the student. There's another teacher in the Chinese collections who had been an archer, had been a hunter in his life before he entered the monastery, turned away from the world, took the backward step to face himself, which is another way we talk about this, turning away from the usual values of the world to look inside. To see what's really important. Not to find some single holy truth, but what's, Suzuki Roshi used to say, what's the most important thing? What do you really care about? Maybe there's several most important things, but what are we doing here? What's the point of your life? What's the point of this practice that helps promote awakening? So this one teacher who was a student of Mazu's was a hunter, and he stumbled into Mazu's monastery because he was chasing a deer that he wanted to kill. And Mazu told him to stop. And later on, when he was a teacher, whenever a student came, he would take his bow and an arrow and as if ready to shoot the student. And one time a student came, and when the teacher did that, he just said, okay, go ahead. How do we receive this teaching? How did Bodhidharma, you know, we could say, why did Bodhidharma face the wall for 9 years? Maybe there's no why. There's no secret meaning. It's just, that's what he did. So this verse commentary by Hongzhe is very interesting. Hongzhe is very poetic and erudite, and there's several references to the great Taoist teacher Zhuangzi in this. So Hongzhe's commentaries were aimed at Chinese literati who knew the Chinese classics, and so he referred to stories from Chinese history and from great Chinese classics like Zhuangzi, one of the great Taoist teachers. Maybe I'll just say a little bit about this, but then I want to open it up to questions and comments about Bodhidharma. Maybe we'll see if Bodhidharma's here. Anyway, Hongzhe says, empty, nothing holy, the approach is far off. Succeeding, he swings the axe without injuring the nose. Failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. Those are both references to famous stories from Zhuangzi, famous in China. This is like if we give commentaries to these stories and reference Beatles lyrics or something, you know, it would be like that, or Shakespeare maybe. Anyway, he swings the axe without injuring the nose, which comes from Zhuangzi saying, very far off, this is about the first part. The thing about swinging the axe is from a story. Zhuangzi was attending a funeral procession. As they passed the great the grave of Sui Si, another great teacher, he turned and said to his followers, Zhuangzi said, as Yingren was plastering a wall, he splashed a bit on his nose. A spot as big as a fly wing of plaster was on his nose. So he had Jiangshu cut it off. He asked Jiangshu to cut it off, one of his friends or students. Jiangshu swung his axe, creating a breeze, and cut it off with a whoosh. so he managed to miss hitting the nose with his axe. Closing his eyes, letting his hands swing freely, he did cut away the whole spot without injuring Yingren's nose. Yingren just stood there without flinching. And Zhuangzi adds, since the death of those people, I have no one capable of being my disciple. The story about the reference from Hongzhe to failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. This is from another story from Zhuangzi. A Meng Min of the latter Han Dynasty, so one of these great ancient Chinese philosophers, stayed in a place during his travels. Once as he was carrying a pitcher, it fell to the ground, but he went on without looking back. Guo Linzhong saw this and asked him the meaning of that. Meng Min replied, "The pitcher is already broken. What's the use of turning back or looking back?" So this is kind of a way of talking about Bodhidharma not returning to see Emperor Wu. He'd already told Emperor Wu everything he had to tell him. And maybe Emperor Wu couldn't hear anymore. Maybe he could. We don't know. So this is a koan about Emperor Wu as well. Anyway, maybe I'll leave Hongzhe's verse just still in silence. Coolly, he sat at Shaolin. In silence, he completely brought up the true imperative. So there's more in the commentary, and there's an introduction, which is interesting. But I think I'll stop now and just ask for comments or questions or responses to Bodhidharma sitting for 9 years facing a wall up in this cave by Shaolin Monastery, or any other part of the story. Questions, comments, responses, please feel free. Asian.
Well, that was the very part of the story that I was thinking about the most, so I'll ask the question that I had about it, which was, maybe it's not a question, but it's kind of just back to a commentary on the riskiness of silence. You know, when a student comes to Bodhidharma and Bodhidharma just, you know, faces the wall and turns away and presumably doesn't say anything, it seems very risky. You know, someone might be able to say, okay, you know, maybe I'll just stick around for a while. Someone else might say, oh, you know, this person doesn't want me here, or, you know, it really kind of hit or miss, to use the other metaphor. I don't know, I guess I have very mixed feelings about that approach.
Good. So that was the approach then. That's what started Chan and Zen. How do we share the teaching? 2018, is it, in Chicago? How does it get conveyed? And maybe we need... Yeah, go ahead. Right. Well, eventually, so to continue the story, the story goes that there was a successor to Bodhidharma, fortunately, named Weka, and he heard about, people started to hear about this Indian master sitting up in a cave in the middle of the snow, because it's cold there in North China. And so he showed up, and he stood outside the cave waiting to talk to Bodhidharma, and Bodhidharma just ignored him. And then one night the legend goes, to prove his sincerity, he stood out all night in the snow, and the snow was up to his waist or whatever, and he cut off his arm and in the morning handed it to Bodhidharma. Now, this is not something that any of you need to do in order to practice Zen fortunately. The story goes that at that point, Bodhidharma was willing to talk to him because he'd proved his sincerity. There are various other ways of proving sincerity short of that. And in fact, historically, we know that Weka had his arm cut off, not in that incident, but previously by a bandit. So he did have one arm, so he was known for that. But then Bodhidharma had other students, and there's a story about four of them, Bodhidharma asking, how do you, you know, what is your teaching, or how do you understand the teaching? And Hueco, of the four, one of them was a nun, too. There were men and women. Bodhidharma just bowed. The others said other wonderful things, but Hueco just bowed, and Bodhidharma said, "You have my marrow." And that was understood as the deepest understanding. To the one of them, he said, "You have my skin, you have my flesh." He said to another, "You have my bones." But Hueco had the marrow, so he got the deepest meaning of Bodhidharma. And became what we call the second ancestor in the lineage we chant. But Dogen has Dogen's commentary on that is that skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are equally Bodhidharma. It's not that one is better than the other. So this is all a great challenge to us. Anne?
It seems like there are two things in your talk that are connected. One is this harshness, you know, he goes away and he's not coming back. Someone cuts off their arms. You know, it's like very harsh. And at the same time, people should be cautious when they're starting to practice or when a country is starting to practice, like a new country is here. And so it seems like the harshness is the expression of caution.
Yes. Thank you.
I think the problem is that our country is very much psychologically oriented.
Right.
So if somebody's very harsh with you, you go see your shrink or something. You might be something wrong with the person. No, seriously. This is a big difference. I practiced in Japan, I practice here, and it's a big difference, you know? I don't know what to do about it.
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know. Just like Bodhidharma didn't know who he was. We don't know who we are. And yes, that's one of the big differences between Asian culture and Western culture, and where this practice is taking on. And we have at least a couple of therapists here in the room, and we have to look at it in different ways. But still, there's this caution. There's this: be careful, take good care of this. How do we convey this carefully?
Yeah, I feel that way. I started Zen and I moved over to Vipassana, and Joseph Goldstein said something once. He was talking about Vipassana mindfulness is sort of in the foreground. It's a very important tool. And he said, "I think it's really good that mindfulness is now very popular. People use it in jails and it helps people in hospitals and stuff." So he said, "I think that's really good. I want to make it clear, I think that's good. But that's mindfulness being used as a tool to make people feel better. And it's not mindfulness as a tool to understand that everything is impermanent."
Right.
He said, "I think it's really good that they're using it in the hospitals and everywhere, but I worry the future generations in America, how deeply they will practice Buddhism." So I think that that question of how deeply, what's going to happen in the future?
Yes.
Is that he also has that feeling of caution or just wondering, what are we going to do? How's this going to work out?
Good. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, Miriam.
Well, this is rather tangential to your talk, but in thinking of the Buddhism as healing and medicine, well, just before I came in, for example, I was looking on my new phone and saw the news that they already had six of those boys out from the cave.
Oh, and, good.
It was sort of, I'm sure by now they've got them all up. The idea of the whole world for once engaging in an act of compassion and concern. Mm-hmm. So, one, it's sort of a nice upbeat in our current situation. But I think it could reflect a lot of Buddhist values, just the whole idea of it.
Yes, thank you. And that's an important difference along with Western psychology, that we have you know, one of the things about Buddhism in this country is that all the different forms of Buddhism, and good teachers from all the different forms of Buddhism, the different forms of Zen, as well as other forms of Buddhism, are here. So we have a way, it's a really unique situation in the history of Buddhism, maybe since the very beginning of Buddhism, where all the different, the ways that Buddhism developed and all the different cultures and all the different approaches to practice are available. And I, one of the things I really appreciate about this Sangha is that people have come from having experience in many different other forms of Zen and Buddhism and other traditions. So that's gives, I think that's a kind of hopeful thing. And also, as you said, people around the world paying attention to some situation, this group of kids in Thailand, and caring about it. Just the caring that happens around the world. That's also something, that communication gives us something that's different from, very different from Bodhidharma's situation. Kyoshin.
I'll say this because I know there are at least two people in this room who have not been to a Dharma talk before, and I have a strong memory of early days of my practice hearing the story that you told tonight, and really liking Emperor Wu and really not liking Dharma.
Good.
Emperor Wu was doing all this great stuff, and Bodhidharma was just horrible. and yet, and this guy cut up his arm, and it was just beyond. I just really didn't get it. And yet, it planted some seed of what Ingham just said, it planted some seed of understanding. There's something much deeper going on here.
Yes.
That I was able to begin to just clean up, start to grapple with. And so if the story doesn't make sense, or if it makes sense backwards, I would say that's okay.
Yeah, it's about deeper awareness, deeper reality, and this practice of Zazen, just sitting facing the wall. Especially if you do it regularly. I recommend doing it at home in your spare time, you know. It doesn't have to be 35 minutes. It can be 15 or 10 minutes even. Just to take some time in your life to stop and sit down and face the wall and face yourself. And whatever happens is okay. It's just sitting. It's not that you have to figure anything out. It's not that something flashy has to happen. It's just being present with yourself in that way. And being present with yourself in that way, it actually connects us to everybody else. Yes, Nyo-san.
Well, there is a tension here, though. In our discussion, we've used things like a deeper reality and all that kind of thing. And there is this one understanding, as expressed in the story of the Bigen, that the marrow is somehow more essential than the bone or the skin or the flesh. And then Dogen comes along and says, well, no, that's not true. The marrow without the skin, the bone, and the flesh, you need the whole works, right?
Right.
And that's what Bodhidharma said. He said, nothing holy.
Right.
It's like you can't sort of separate something else or something off and say, this is important, this is not important, more important, all that stuff. So there's this kind of tension here. I don't have anything to say about it, I just wanted to point it out. Because I mean, I tend to agree on this point with Dogen, and I can't remember the fascicle, but in regard to Emperor Wu and Emperor Wu's good works and merit and all that kind of stuff, there's a fascicle in Dogen, and maybe you can point out which one it is, where Dogen is trying to encourage people to like get a temple built.
Yeah.
And he's sort of saying, doing meritorious things and building a temple and making the bricks, that's precisely the Buddha work. So again, you get this kind of deconstruction of this sort of tendency to hierarchize.
Right, good. Yeah, yeah. And it's not that there's you know, Bodhidharma said no merit to Emperor Wu, but of course, you know, and I think the word merit is, you know, we think of merit badges or something. It just, we can understand it as just this positive, creative, constructive, helpful energy that happens from Zazen and happens from doing positive, helpful things. So,
this whole idea of merit, which is, seems about set aside largely in Zen with Bodhidharma, it's much more allied to the Theravada traditions. If you think of it as a sort of a system of accounting, right, where you get stuff in the bank and then you get you get enough greens, savings stamp or whatever, and you get a toaster, and you get a license. That seems to be one idea that Bodhidharma is quite correctly, dismissing. On the other hand, if you're talking about creating the conditions for your own awakening, the awakening of others, that's quite a different thing. And you don't know what's going to work. Whether setting up a little place on a green park road is going to have any effect or not. And it can't. So
right.
you just see.
Yeah. Good, thank you. Yeah, and then just the last point, jumping off from what you said, is that Dogen also emphasizes there is the side of practice of deepening, to put it that way, awareness, not reaching some ultimate state, but deepening our awareness and our openness and our steadiness to be more helpful in the world. But the point of that Dogen emphasizes is how do you express that? And so to express... So we, being right out on the storefront, we come to sit to find some steadiness and some openness. But then the point is, how do we use that to be helpful in the world? So, yeah, both sides.